Okay, I'd like everyone to please help me welcome our speaker. It's Patty B. from St. Petersburg, Florida, Monday night, 7:30, speakers meeting.
And that is my home group, and it starts at 7:30, and it's so awesome. I moved to Florida about 4 months ago, and I joined that group. I had a bunch of names and numbers to get in contact with people when I got there, because I got sober in New York, Pennsylvania, and I was there for 7 years, and I just moved to Florida 4 months ago, like I said, and I had a bunch of these names and numbers, and people were active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where they were, and I got there, and I love the group. It's my favorite home group I've had since I've been sober. It's my third home group, and it's my favorite. When they say that at the beginning of the meeting, the whole home group gets up and does a wave, and it's so fabulous. And there's about, like, I don't know, like 2,000 years of sobriety there. Everybody has, like, 150 years of sobriety. I'm like, wow. So it's pretty cool. And they're all active. All these old guys are pretty active, you know, and the women too. So I love it. But when I first got there, people told me, you know, Patty, it's going to be like, you're going to be like a newcomer. You know, it's going to be scary. And I'm like, got it. I've been sober almost 7 years. I got this under control. And I tell you, and I got there, and all the fears that I had when I first got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous came right back. I had to walk into new rooms as a newcomer, meet new people, and all that fear and all that stuff that I had from the very beginning when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous just came flooding right back. But I tell you that the awesome thing about it is that I am more effective now helping newcomers because I know exactly how they feel, you know, because I kind of like forgot what it feels like, all that fear, you know, showing up in a new place, starting all over again. So that's the good thing about it. And my sobriety date is June 10, 2002. And I'll be forever grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it's given me a whole brand new life. Not a passed up old life. And I never wanted to get sober. I had a lot of fun drinking. And it worked for a really long time. And you know, I had a lot of stuff that happened. I had a lot of things. I had no things. I had husbands, you know, I had kids, I had money, I didn't have money. I moved all over the place. I went to places that some people haven't gone to, and some people have gone further than me. And none of that makes me an alcoholic. The fact that I drank for 23 years and have 5 DUIs and drank every day doesn't make me an alcoholic, you know. What makes me an alcoholic is that I'm not like a normal person. I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. Once I start drinking, it sets off a phenomenon of craving. Sets off an allergy. So once I start, I cannot stop. And when I do stop, all I do is think about drinking. So some of you may not be able to relate to some of the things that I've been through throughout my drinking. And some of you may. And people who may not aren't as old as me, that's all. But if you go back out, you keep drinking, you get as old as me, you probably will. And I hope you don't have to go to the ones I went to. And I was born in New Jersey. And we have a Jersey crew here. And I had a dad who was a drunk. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he was a drunk, and he drank all the time. And he was so fabulous. You know, I don't have horror stories like my father beating me or molesting me. I loved him. I thought he was awesome. He was so funny, and he was sarcastic and nasty and drunk all the time. And I just thought he was awesome. I loved him. I loved to be around him, you know what I mean? And sometimes my mom would let me go to the bars with him, and I loved it, you know. It was so awesome. It was dark and dirty and smoky, and the jukebox was playing, and I just couldn't wait to grow up to get to those places. You know, I never had dreams like to go to college or to get married. I never wanted to do any of those things. The only thing I ever wanted to do was hurry up and grow up because it was boring. And in kindergarten, life was so hard. You know, I couldn't wait till I could grow up and get out of here. You know, and I had a mom, and she was awesome. And she died when I was 25. But she took care of the house and the kids and my father, and her life looked so worn, and I never wanted to be like my mom, and I never was anything like my mom. I guarantee you that. But even before I picked up a drink, there something was not right with me. My father really believed like I was like slightly retarded. He really did. Because when I was 3 years old, I got really sick and I had encephalitis, and it had something to do with the brain. And so he just believed that like I was slightly retarded. But I believed that I was born with a spiritual malady. My whole life, I just felt different than everybody else. I was terrified. I just couldn't wait to grow up, because once I grew up, I knew it would be a lot easier, you know. And my father would drink every single night, all night long he drank. And then he'd get up in the morning, he'd drink coffee, and he'd go to work, and he never missed work. And I don't think he ever came out of his blackout naked in another state. You know, I don't think he did any other things, you know. But I loved him so much, and I would get up with my dad in the middle of the night and watch black and white movies with him, and I'd get him a beer. And I'd pop it open, and I'd drink as much as I possibly could until I got into the living room. I don't remember the effects produced by alcohol at that young age, but I know I did it every night. And I do remember my first drunk, and I tell you, without a doubt, it was my very first spiritual experience, because it was so hard. Life was so hard for me. It was hard for me to breathe. I was uncomfortable in my own skin. I couldn't look people in the eye. I was absolutely terrified, and I didn't even know how much my head was attacking me until I got drunk that first time. And all that stuff, I could look at you in the eye. I could care less if you were looking at me. I was comfortable in my own skin. I could breathe easy. I found something that made me feel so okay. I was absolutely so okay. But of course, what happens for me, yes, I started drinking, and I immediately became seductive, you know, and the clothes came off, and I went into a blackout. And so that's how I drank from the very beginning to the very end. And I tell you, and that first night when I went into that blackout, I absolutely loved it. I loved it because life felt so hard for me, like I said. And when you're in a blackout, I felt like I was invisible. And when life is hard and you're invisible, it's pretty good, you know. And since I love the effects produced by alcohol so much, and I found something that made me so okay, that very first night I was never going to wait for anybody ever to offer me alcohol ever again. And I lived up the street from a liquor store, and I took my lunch money every day, and I got all men to buy me alcohol. So I was a daily drinker from the very beginning. I mean, for the first time, I found something that was so awesome that I could not do it every day. You know, and when you're 14 years old and you're blacked out and you're thinking you're seductive and naked, you get in a lot of trouble. You do. And I got in a lot of trouble, and I had a lot of consequences from the very beginning. You know, at the age of 14, I was at the beach, and I met these two guys, and they asked me if I wanted to go drinking with them. I was like, absolutely, you know. And so I got in the car with these two guys, and I didn't know who they were. Nor did I care. I just knew I was going to be drinking with them. And what happened that day absolutely changed my life. And what happened that day is I wound up getting brutally beaten and raped, which, like I said, none of that makes me an alcoholic. But I tell you what it did. It made me a victim, and it was 30 years ago, and they didn't know what to do. And my family was devastated, and they figured, well, if I was raped, I probably need to drink too. Let's just leave her alone. She'll grow out of this. Just let her drink. So I was allowed to drink at the age of 14 the way I needed to drink, and I really believed that I didn't have any suicide attempts throughout high school because I was allowed to drink the way I needed to drink. Mm-hmm. You know, and I barely made it through high school. I started seeing tons and tons and tons of psychiatrists, and they started saying stuff to me like, Patty, you're very depressed. And they started putting me on medication, and they would tell me stuff like, Patty, if you drink on this medication, it's going to triple the effect of alcohol. And I'm like, that is awesome. You were good for something, you know. And so I was blacked out even quicker, you know. And I did graduate high school with a note from one of my many psychiatrists saying that if I didn't graduate, that I'd have a breakdown. And they just wanted to get rid of me, so they graduated. So I graduated, and I just went to my 25-year high school reunion a couple months ago. And which is kind of weird, but whatever. So anyway, I'm surprised they didn't let me in. But because I was not real, like, real well liked in high school, because I kind of tortured the jocks and threatened to kill them and stuff like that. So I wasn't like a really nice person. And so I graduated high school, and my family was like, "You're 18 years old. You graduated high school. It's time for you to go." And I was like, "See ya." And I left home at the age of 18. And I started getting in a lot of trouble. Started getting DUIs and getting arrested a lot. And my life started to become a little unmanageable. And I really needed to do something, because I really didn't feel like I had a reason and purpose for living besides drinking. But I wanted to do something. And the only thing I ever wanted to do was to be a mother. And I figured it would control my drinking. You know, I'd be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And I would have someone to love and someone to always love me. And that's what I set out to do. I set out to get pregnant. And I found a really dumb guy. More than willing. And I got pregnant. And my mother was a little upset that I was pregnant because I was raised Catholic. And she thought it was best if I got married. And I already caused enough harm, you know. And I figured, well, I ain't going to stay married, you know what I mean? But I'll get married, you know. So one of my many, many psychiatrists that I have was a reverend. So my psychiatrist married me. I married this guy, and this is how my dad describes me. I tell you how fabulous and funny he is. He says that if I was in Shea Stadium with all brain surgeons, that I would pick up the hot dog vendor. So I married the hot dog vendor, and he got a job. And it's probably the only job he's ever had since then. And so he went off to work, and I left. And I had this little, and I had my little girl. And I tell you, I loved my little girl with all my heart and soul. I loved her so much. And alcoholism is so powerful. It's more powerful than a mother's love. Because I wanted to do the best job I could. I really did. You know, she went to the best daycare. She did. She had the best clothes. We had nice places to live. I worked all the time. But she never had a mom. Never had a mom. And every year, I'd get a big income tax check because I have a kid now. And I'd take that income tax check, and I'd drop her off at her father's, and I'd go off on a vacation because I deserve that. And I'd leave that little girl behind. And I got to go to a lot of places, and I don't remember seeing anything because I was blacked out. But the one vacation that I remember, because it was so dramatic for me, is when I was vacationing in Southern California. I met a really hot guy. And what I like to do is I like to lie. And I like to tell you anything you want to hear. I like to try to impress you. I like to be whatever you want me to be, just so you'll like me, just so I feel part of. And that's what I did with this guy. He's really, he was a Marine. And he was stationed in Southern California from Minnesota. And he's really, really athletic, and I am really, really not. And and he's into, like, the ice, the winter sports, like ice hockey and skiing and stuff like that. And I just figured that, like, I live in Jersey and he lives in California, and I just want to impress him. And I can't get caught lying. So what I tell him is I tell him that I'm an expert skier. I just want him to like me, and I want to impress him. And so that's what I tell him, and I get back to Jersey. And he liked me, and he was impressed by me, because he called me up, and he said, "Patty, I'm going to come to Jersey, and I'm going to take you skiing in Vermont." And I thought, that is absolutely fabulous. I never drank in Vermont. And so my plan was, this is my plan, this is my thing, I'm going to get him good and loaded, because he really wants to ski when you could drink. But he isn't like me, and he really wants to ski and not drink. So we're going up the expert hill, because he thinks I'm an expert skier. And it's really high. It's really, really high. And I'm like shaking, you know what I mean? And he's like, "Are you all right?" I'm like, "Haven't skied in a while. A little nervous, you know?" I've never skied even to this day. And so we get all the way up to the top of the mountain. And I don't know how to get off the ski lift. I barely got on the ski lift, you know? And so I pull up the ski lift, and I get tangled up, so they have to shut down the whole ski lift to untangle it. And so I say to him, I say, well, I haven't skied in a while. Why don't you go ahead and ski, and I'll just take my time, and I'll just meet you down at the bottom of the mountain. So he takes off skiing, because he really skis, you know. And and it took me 4 hours to get down that mountain. Climb, crawl. I mean, it was a mess. I was like emotionally drained by that, you know. And I made a promise to myself that day that I would never ever lie about being athletic ever again. I just couldn't pull it off, but I would do crazy stuff and lie and try to be somebody I wasn't. I didn't even know who I was, and I was so empty on the inside, and I just wanted to be like desperately. You know, and every time my life would get unmanageable, and I divorced that guy, that contract vendor, I got rid of him. and every time my life would get unmanageable, I would get pregnant again. And I wound up getting pregnant 2 more times. And by the time I was pregnant, the 3rd time, in my first 2 times I was pregnant, I was able to stop drinking. By the time I was pregnant with my 3rd daughter, I could not stop drinking. And I didn't want to hurt this baby, you know. And like I said, I love my kids with all my heart and soul. And I didn't want to do this. No matter how much I loved them, I couldn't stop. You know, and I had the baby left inside me. And I had holy water blessed by the Pope that I put on my stomach every day. And I had prayer services going on all over the country. And I could do all those things, but I couldn't stop drinking. And the day she came, I was terrified because I didn't tell the doctor what I was doing. And I didn't know what I did to her. And my best friend came with me, and when I delivered her, the doctor went to hand me her and wouldn't take her because I was scared. I was scared what I did to her. And I handed her to my best friend, and when she smiled, I knew that she was okay. You know, and I had these 3 little girls that I tell you I loved. And I wound up marrying their father, and he was a chef. So he was like an upgrade at the hot dog vendor, you know what I mean? And he was a really good chef. He would send out his resume, and they'd come in, and they'd pack us up, and they'd move us off, and I got to move to a lot of cool places. But I never wanted to be married. So I never acted like a married woman, you know? So wherever we went, it was all kinds of chaos, and my husband would send out another resume. They'd come in and pack them up, and he'd leave with the kids, and I'd stay behind in whatever state we were in until I started missing my kids, and then I'd follow behind. And I tell you, my relationship with my ex-husband, my second ex-husband, was very abusive. It was mentally, physically abusive. And by no means do I think I am a victim. I know I showed up and participated in everything in my life, but I tell you, I was willing to go to any length to drink. I was. And I knew if I pissed him off and pushed him hard enough, he would hit me. And he'd beat me up and he'd feel really bad. And he'd leave me alone for at least a week. And then I could drink for the way I wanted to for at least a week. And I was willing to take a beating to drink the way I needed to drink. And I had coffee cups filled all over the house, filled with vodka behind picture frames. Just in case he tried to take away my bottle, I would have a backup. And so we came in my drink, and we ended up living in Georgia, and we had this restaurant, and I am a complete disaster. I am absolutely out of my mind, and I'm having an affair again, and my husband's had it with me. And he comes home from work, and he drags me into the bedroom, and he gets on top of me, and he strangles me till I pass out. And I come to, and he looks at me, and he says to me, he said, Patty, if you were ever afraid of me, tonight's the night to be afraid of me because I'm going to kill you. And I could see there was something different in his eyes, and he meant it. And he started strangling me again until I almost passed out, and he fell off of me. And I got away, and I called the police. And they came, and they got him, and they arrested him. And he was thrown in jail, and he had really high bail on him. And I have this restaurant to run, and I am a mess. And the police called one day when I was at the restaurant, and they said that he was bailed out of jail, and that he was packing up his stuff because he wasn't allowed to stay at the house. And it was Christmas time, and I had my daughters with me at the restaurant. And I already had 6 bottles of wine that day. And I started to think, what my problem really was Georgia. What I need to do is get back to Jersey. If I get back to Jersey, I'll be okay. So I got my kids in the car, and I stopped, and I got a 100-proof bottle of vodka. and I was going to go home and drink the vodka, pack up the car and the kids, and I was going to head to Jersey. And what happened is I came to, and my house was filled with police and the neighbors. And not only was my husband packing up his stuff, but he was packing up my little girl's stuff. And the police said to me that my little girls were better off with him than a drunk as a mother. And I know they were absolutely right. Because what I would do every single day with my little girls is I would get them in my car. And I would drive in blackouts and endanger their lives every single day. I would run over railroad tracks and blow out the tires in my car. And I would hit trees. And they were absolutely terrified. And I did it every single day. And thank God I never hurt them or anybody else on the road. And I tell you, that's not the person I wanted to be. That's not the mother I wanted to be. I wanted to be a good mother. And my favorite speaker, he talks about how he's on a bus with his little girl and he comes to. And she's shaking and she's holding her stomach. And she says to him, and he says to her, "What's the matter, honey?" And he says, she says, "Daddy, I'm so hungry, you forgot to feed me again." And they get into a bus stop, and they go into the bus stop, and he gets a sandwich, and he gets a bottle of wine. And when he gets to the counter, he only has enough money for one, and he puts back her sandwich. And that's the kind of drunk I was. And I knew he had nowhere to go with these little girls, so I left. And I tore through St. Petersburg, Florida, really quick. And I came back to Georgia because I had nowhere to go. And by the time I got back to Georgia, I weighed 80 pounds. And I was bruised from head to toe from falling. And I was yellow and I had this long hair. And it was falling out and I had ball patches all over my head. And I couldn't go 20 minutes without a drink. Because if I tried to go 20 minutes without a drink, I would shake so violently. My skin would crawl, I would feel like I was hyperventilating. My head would attack me so bad that I wouldn't know what else to do but just to take another drink. And since I can't go 20 minutes without a drink and the condition I was in, I couldn't work in the public and nobody would hire me. And I had nowhere to go. And I moved into this crack hotel. And I tell you, things that I wound up doing every single day to get me out of me, to get me a bottle of vodka, was an absolute nightmare because that's not how I was raised. And that's where I went. And that's what I had to do to drink. And every day was just so hard. And I was just so lonely, you know, and I missed my kids. And I just knew I couldn't take care of them because I couldn't go without this drink. And I just wanted to die. And I don't know women who are doing the things that I'm doing. And, drinking the way I drank. But I think I heard somewhere that people who do drugs are doing these things, you know. And so since I'm living in a crack hotel, I start thinking to myself, I should start smoking some of this crack and feel a little bit better about myself, you know what I mean? So that's what I tried to do. I tried to smoke crack and I was better at skiing. I didn't know how to coordinate it, there's pushes involved and all kinds of stuff I couldn't do. And the crackheads, they absolutely hated me. And you know you're pretty bad when the crackheads hate you. Because you know what they do, since some of you guys might have some of this experience, what they do is they smoke crack and they get really paranoid and they hide. And the last person they want to be found by is me. So I did try to become a drug addict, but it didn't work out well for me. The crackhead's like, just give her back her bottle. But across the street from my crack hotel was this car dealership, and the mayor owned it, and he cut the ribbon to our restaurant. And I went over there and I got a job. And I got a job detailing cars in the parking lot, so I didn't have to be out in the public, and I could drink the way I needed to drink, you know. And I stopped doing those things. And I moved out of that hotel, and I moved into a trailer park. And I went into work one day, and the mayor asked me, where are the keys to the van? And I don't know why I had these keys, but I had these keys back at my house. And he said, we're selling that vehicle today. We need those keys. You need to grab something off this lot and go home and get those keys. So I grabbed a big red truck, because I love trucks. And I went home to get the keys, and while I was there, I figured, I'll go have a few drinks, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, it was like 6 drinks later, and I was like, I got to get back to work. So I start rushing to get back to work, and I come to, and the truck is completely total. And there's police and ambulance and cop cars around, and they get me in an ambulance, and they take me off to the hospital, and they put 150 stitches in my face.
And from there, they take me off to jail. And when they shut the doors on me, I was so relieved. I was so relieved to be locked away. Because I really believed the only way I would stop drinking is if I was locked away. And that was my 50-year wallet. And so I've been to AA. The state of New Jersey definitely has sent me to AA. Not that I listened or cared about it, but I just thought the only way I would ever stop is if I was locked away. My parents tried bailing me out. I wouldn't even get bailed out. Because I just wanted to be locked away. Because I didn't want to do those things I was doing. But he eventually bailed me out. And now I'm back at the trailer park, and I'm doing the same things I was doing in that hotel. And I'm telling you, my head is killing me. No matter how much I'm drinking, I can't get into a bathroom. My skin is crawling. I miss my kids so much. I am so lonely. And I'm so tired. And I can't believe where I wound up. And my world is just so small, so dark, and so dirty. And I just wanted to die. I just couldn't do it another day. I just could not do it. Another day in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the loneliness that only another alcoholic knows. And I tell you, I was so lonely. And I just missed those kids, man. And I knew that I'd be better off dead. And I always prayed, always have I prayed. I would pray to St. Jude. He's the patron saint of hopeless and despair cases. Because I thought God was so far out there that I would need to pray through the saints to get to God because I was so bad. And they say, I didn't say a prayer to God. I mean, they surely said a prayer to God. And I said, God, you can help me because I can't do this. And I took a bottle of Tylenol PM and I drank a half a gallon of vodka. And I came to on June 10th, 2002 in intensive care. And my family flew in. Because they said I wasn't going to make it, and my father really believed he was going to take me home in a body bag. And they took all kinds of tests and stuff, and finally it came back that I had no damage whatsoever. And they shipped me off to a mental hospital, which is my favorite part of getting sober. I loved it there. It was awesome. People were crazy and nutty, and oh my God, it was fabulous. I loved it. And they felt safe, you know? And I just wanted to live there forever. And you know what they have there? They have these, and it wasn't like a psych ward, it was a whole hospital, you know. And they have these cages where they bring you out and they let you smoke, and they have these things on the wall, like the cigarette lighters in your car that get red. Well, the airport in Tampa, which I flew out, I have the same cages, like the psych ward. I was like, wow, this is awesome. And now Tampa's my favorite airport. So anyway, but they kept me there long enough for like a stuff shake until they can get me on the plane and get me back to Jersey. And they got me back to Jersey, and they got me into a rehab, and I had 7 days in this rehab because that's all my husband's insurance would cover. And I'm telling you, I am a mess. I am a mess. I am still so shaky. I can't hold a pencil. I can't read. I can't write. And I can't form a sentence. And they want me to do workbooks and worksheets, and I just can't do it. And they take me up into the office because they're going to get me funding. And they go through my workbooks and my worksheets, and nothing is completed. And they told me I wasn't serious about recovery and I needed to go. And they just started to cry because they had nowhere to go. And you know, if I got back out there, I'd be doing the same thing I was doing. And I never wanted to go back. I never wanted to feel that pain. I never wanted to go do the things that I had to do to get a bottle of vodka. And so what they decided to do with me was to send me to York, Pennsylvania. And I don't know anything about York, Pennsylvania, AA, recovery, I know nothing. But I just know one thing. I never want to feel that way ever again. And I'm willing to do whatever they tell me to do. And I get to York, Pennsylvania, and I'm telling you, I am scared to death. I was in a lot of places. And this is the first time I've ever moved absolutely sober. And I was not. And I walk into this recovery house, and one of the girls who lives in the house is on the phone. And she stops what she's doing, and she takes one look at me. And she said, oh my God. This one is a real doozy. I think she has what brain. And I'm like, oh my God, now I got what brain. I have no idea what it is, you know what I mean? And I'm like, next. I am a complete disaster. You know, and I'm showing up to meetings and I don't know what's going on. Everybody's talking in a different language and I'm just never going to get this. Because I am so much worse than everybody. The things that I did. Because nobody took anything from me. I gave everything away. I gave those kids away and I gave away my soul. And I am just so different, and I don't know what's going on around me.
And I come back home and I ask her, I'm like, are you sure I have wet brain? She's like, oh yeah, pretty sure you got wet brain. And she said, not only do you have wet brain, but everybody in AA is talking about you. And I knew they were all looking at me, you know what I mean? She said, they're all calling you Skeletor. So I'm a mess, you know what I mean? I have wet brain, they're calling me Skeletor. I'm a mess, you know? But you know, I have nowhere to go. And when you're home, you're out of ideas. And it wasn't like a pretty good idea, and I'm showing up to different meetings. And I start hearing women share. And they're sharing from their heart. And they drank the way I drank. And they did the same things that I did when I was I'm not that way today. So then I knew I wasn't different and I wasn't worse than everybody else. And then we hear people talk about the hole in the soul, how they felt like they had a hole in their soul. And that's how I felt my whole life, like I had a hole in my soul. I could just never put words to it. And I would hear them talk about how they could walk in a room full of people and how alone and lost they felt. And that's also how I felt my whole life. And I didn't know people felt that way. I just thought it was me. And I thought it was crazy. And I seen this one woman and she absolutely glowed. And I know it was God. Because I hear people talk about how they walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and they see the people with the bright shiny eyes. And I tell you, when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't see anybody's bright shiny eyes. Because I was filled with such guilt and shame for the things that I did that I couldn't lift my head up. And this woman, she absolutely glowed. And she talked about how she felt like this going there her whole life and she didn't feel that way today. And she certainly didn't look that way. And I went up and I asked her if she'd be my sponsor. And she asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths, and I said, absolutely not. I went to any lengths to drink, you know. And what she told me, because now I guess I'm about 45 to 60 days sober, and I'm telling you, I am like out of my freaking mind. I was at the grocery store, the 15 item or less aisle, and they questioned me on my items, and I wanted to kill the guy. And I'm crying, and I'm throwing fits, and I'm going to want to kill people. And that house is like, she needs to be medicated, you know what I mean? And so when I meet this woman, she tells me, she said, you know, Patty, your whole life, people have been telling you if you just stop drinking, you'd be okay. She said, when you stop drinking, you are definitely not okay. She said, because drinking has never been your problem. Drinking has always been your solution. She said, now that you don't have that solution, you need to find a new solution. She said, what I had was a spiritual malady, and what I needed was a spiritual solution. And she said, what I needed to do was to do these 12 steps. She told me that if I didn't do the 12 steps, I would die. And she told me everything I think I need and want, I'm going to put on the back burner, and I'm going to come and learn how to live this way of life with her. And that's exactly what it is. She told me I needed to chase my recovery, and I could chase my drinking, and I absolutely do. And I would travel to drink, you know what I mean? So I travel for AA, especially since it's given me a brand new life. Well, when you want to share the good news, that there's a way up and a way out, that you never have to live that way ever again. And she told me that everything in this world is temporary. The only thing that's everlasting is God. And she said, I must have a strong foundation with God. She said, I must have a love affair with God. Because there's going to come a time when the only thing that's going to come between me and a drink is God. And she said, we're going to start to work on these 12 steps right out of the big book. And that's what we did. And I tell you, I didn't understand what was going on around me. I didn't. Because you still think I have wet brain, and I don't want her to find out about the wet brain, you know what I mean? Find out she might fire me, you know? So I'm doing everything this woman tells me to do. You know, I finally get a job, and she said, you're going to get up every morning, you're going to say that third step for her, you're going to help as many people as you can. If you can't help them, you're not going to hurt them. And so that's what I started to do. You know, I'm showing up to work, I'm so freaking helpful. People are giving me awards, you know what I mean? I'm being helpful with all the girls at the house and going to meetings, and they come home. I had to throw myself on the kitchen floor and I cried. Every single night I want to drink so bad. Every single day I'm just holding on because I just want to drink. And every time I finally do fall asleep, all I do is have drunk dreams all night long. And this is not working for me. And I miss my kid. And I'm doing everything she's telling me to do and it's not working for me. And I go to her and I tell her all this stuff, you know. And I said, I don't think God is hearing my prayers anymore. And she said, you know what, Patty? I asked her, I just want to hug my kids just for 5 minutes. That's all I want. And she told me, she said, Patty, you don't have to physically hug your kids. God can hug them for you. And she said, I want you to go home and I want you to pray about that tonight. And that's what I did, because I did everything she told me to do. And I prayed that, and I prayed that, said a prayer, and I went to bed that night. And I had a dream, and I walked into a room, and all three of my children were there, and I could feel them hug me.
And then 2 days later, somehow, my middle daughter got my phone number, and she called me. And I told her about my dream, and she said, "Oh my God, Mom, I have the same dream." So God could bring me my children together in our dreams. God could do anything. And I tied it that obsession with lifting, and I stopped having those strong dreams. And I did a fourth and fifth step with this woman, and what she told me that the things that I did when I was out there doesn't make me who I am. They're just things that I did. And that I needed to do everything I did when I was out there and drink everything I drank so I can get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous so I never have to go back out. And she said, all those dirty, disgusting things that I thought I did when I was out there were going to be my biggest gifts to help other women. And she's absolutely right that you get to help 20 women. And I don't regret my past, you know. And I tell you, and I walked away from that fifth step, with being able to lift my head up a little bit higher, start looking people in the eye, you know. And at this time, the state of Georgia is looking for me, because I'm wanted in three different counties and a couple states and stuff like that. And she said, Patty, because it's my 5th of July. I mean, I totaled a car left at the mayor on me. I'm in serious trouble, you know what I mean? And she said, we need to get moving along on these steps. You know, she didn't rush me through the steps, but we moved through pretty quickly. My grandfather, he says, Patty, did you ever go walk through a barroom's doors slowly? So why would you do this slowly? I know. So, but she said, I have so many amends. I made so many, but I still have tons to make. But she said, we're going to start with the closest state. So they sent me back to Jersey. And they shipped me back with this man and his girlfriend who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous who never met me. And they put me up for a week. And this man took me out every single day to do my amends. I'm just amazed. Like, if he didn't even know me, just because I was another alcoholic, he laid down his life for me. And he took me out to start making my amends. And I tell you, I love my father. Loved him to death. And we started getting really close because I was in contact with him all the time now. And a week before I got to Jersey to start making my amends, he said to me, Patty, he said, you know what, I think you got this alcohol thing licked. I think you're going to be all right for the first time in your life. Because he doesn't understand. He stopped drinking. He was good to go, you know. But he said, and I'm real tired. I'm real tired. I feel like I live a life as a houseplant. And I tell you, my dad has been real sad since my mother died. And it's almost like he held on, you know, to have, because he thought I was like slightly retarded and like out of my mind. And for the first time, I know he's going to be mad. You know, so when I get to Jersey and my first amends, he's going to be with my dad. And I can't find him. And I finally get in touch with my brothers and my sister, and they said that he had a stroke that morning. And he's in critical condition, and he's paralyzed. And my sponsor said I still have to go make the amends and to ask everybody to leave the room. And that's what I did. And they said everything she told me to say, and I told him I was wrong. I didn't say I was sorry. She said, you've been sorry your whole life. You tell him you're wrong. And that you're never going to be that person. And hopefully you'll never be that person ever again if you continue doing the things that you're doing. And that's what I said to him. And my dad, he started to cry. And he didn't manage to say the words, I love you. And he died about a week later. And my dad did get to see me sober before he died. You know, when I asked him to come to the end, and I asked him to make amends with both those ex-husbands, so my second ex-husband told me, he said, Patty, he said, I really was going to kill you that night. He said, the only reason I didn't kill you is because the bright white light came and hit me in the head and knocked me off of you. And like I told you, God, that little God is so far out there. And the whole time, I've always been in the palm of God's hand. You know, when I've been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have had a spiritual awakening. And I tell you, when I got through these steps and had a spiritual awakening, I was like out of my freaking mind. I was like out to save the world. But I did go back to Georgia and go in front of that judge. And I was told that the judge's daughter was killed a year earlier from a drunk driver. And the mayor's mother was also killed by a drunk driver. And so it didn't look good. But I tell you, I knew at this point that God was in charge. And then if I was supposed to go to jail, I was going to carry this message in jail. You know, and I went in front of that judge and she gave me 24 hours in jail. Mm-hmm. You know, and I guess God will respect that if I'm out here carrying this message, you know. And I do have my license back today. took me 3 years to get it back. But I do have a license. And I have a car, and it's registered and insured. I'm licensed in one state, not the right state, but I'm still licensed in one state.
I just got a ticket for not having the right plate on my car. I'll take care of that when I get back. or it could be kind of just not such a chance. Who knows? But you know, I have had a spiritual awakening. You know, and when I had that spiritual link and I was out to save the world, I would tell you, I was out of my mind. I was picking homeless people up. You know, I had people shipping me homeless people. You know, it was like crazy. I had to do like 40 hours of community service for my PCOI, and I did it at this woman's homeless shelter, and I tell you, I had all these women out in the parking lot on their knees doing the third step. These people were going to get sober whether they're drunks or not, you know what I mean? I was in love trying to take people through the steps who weren't an alcoholic. I'm like, this will improve your life. Let's go. Let's move it. You know, crazy. I had this apartment, right, and it was an old storefront, so the ceilings were really high. And I had my friend Jim Bach from Jersey. He bought me lumber, and I was going to build we were going to have somebody build a loft. And I was going to start stacking these drunks. You know, I was going to save them. And what happened is nobody got sober. Except for me. I'm the only one who stayed sober. Because what I found out what I was doing was I was denying people their pain. And nobody denied me my pain. You know, and if they did, I wouldn't be here today. So I stopped doing those things. I'm still like a lunatic, like out trying to save the world, but not in that kind of way. I'm not forcing this down people's throat, making them want to get sober. And even if they were sober, I was making them like experience all I think they need it, you know. It's crazy. But I tell you, I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you, I have so much fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have my little girls back in my life. The reason I wound up moving to Florida is that's where my little girls live. They live in Florida. And every year, they would come and spend the summers with me. And every year, and harder for me to send them back, you know. For not being there. I missed so much stuff. I missed their soccer games. I missed everything. And so this year when they went back, I was just like, my heart was killing me. You know, and I just started praying for God to make it obvious where I'm supposed to be, if I'm supposed to stay in North Pennsylvania or I'm supposed to go to Florida. And little by little, God started clearing the path. You know? I mean, the work got really slow where I could actually work from home. It just was like very obvious that I was supposed to be in Florida with these little girls, because I tell you, they come every summer and they loved going to meetings. Not so much last year, because now they're like teenagers, so 12 and 14. But before that, they loved it. They loved the drugs. I mean, who doesn't? They're fabulous. We're fabulous, you know what I mean? It's the best show on earth. That's my fault for that. And so they loved it. And well, like the 1 year, it was 2 years ago, they came for the summer, and while they were in Pennsylvania, their father was getting sober in Florida, and so they go to meetings all the time with men, and they babysit and stuff. And when they get back to Florida, they ask their dad. He says, "Dad, can we go to a meeting with you?" And he's like, "I guess you go to meetings with your mom, you know." And they got to this meeting in Florida, and my little girl said to their dad, "Dad, they're not doing it right here." Happy to join North Pennsylvania. And what step are you on? And they made him switch sponsors, but they watch what they want. These kids watch. They watch me get girls through the steps. They can watch them change. They see it. And so their father wasn't experiencing what these girls had in my house were experiencing. So they just gave him a little nudge, maybe a little kick, and he got a different sponsor, you know. And so I get to Florida, right? And God's making it obvious, and I know this is part of God's plan. I mean, it's just fabulous. Everything's falling into place. I get an apartment online. The day before I get there, I find this fabulous furniture. The day before I get there, I'm like, oh my God, this is definitely a God thing. I'm supposed to be here. I mean, this is going to be awesome. And I get there, and their father, who's now 2 years sober, is a little untreated, baby. And he won't let me see my kids. And now I'm alone in Florida. And I get to see them whenever he says I can, like,
like if you can't get to pick them up at school, and I get to get like, you know, crumbs and pieces of it, of when he feels I get to see them. And then he shows up at my home group, and he threatens me in front of all these people. I mean, like major scene, like stuff like that would happen like with us out of the bar, and I'm absolutely horrified. You know what I mean? And now I'm scared. All that fear and stuff that I had when I was married to him is coming back. You know, and I'm in a new place. And I hardly know anybody. I just have the four people that I got the numbers of. And I'm so alone. And I can't see my kids. And it's getting harder for me to breathe because I'm terrified to go to meetings. You know, and these guys in AA, there's like five of them. And they're like 8 foot tall, right? And they see what's going on. They see that this man is attacking me in these meetings and stalking me and showing up to my house. And they see it, right? And I'm afraid to go to my home group, but I'm not letting anybody run me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I show up to my home group the next week after this happened. And these eight guys just surround me and protect me and walk me into the meeting, you know? And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, these guys are my bodyguards, and I just kept showing up because I wasn't letting him run me out of AA, because I found something here that you can't find anywhere. And eventually, he lightened up because he knew he wasn't going to scare me, you know. And he called me a couple weeks ago because, like I said, he's a chef, you know. He's had my little girl for the last 7 years, And he is a good father. He's not a good husband. And I wasn't a good wife. You know, and there's just too much from our past. You know what I mean? That's just like, I guess, unsolved. You know what I mean? I guess with time and God's help, all that will clear itself out. But he called me up the other day and said he got a job in Maine. Mm-hmm. He got a job as a chef at a hotel in Maine, seasonal. And then he'll be gone for 6 months. And so I get my little girl for the next 6 months, and he won't even be at my home group, you know. But I knew I was supposed to be there, but it was just so hard for the first couple of months, you know, and I got really backed up because it's real expensive to move, so I had to take on a second job, and I was waitressing at this, at this diner, right, and all this stuff is going on, and I am not spiritually fit whatsoever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I get into my car to go home, and this busboy follows me after my car, and he tries to kiss me, so I smack him with all my might, you know? Like the jerky's coming back, the entree is jerky, you know? And so I get up for the next day, I'm in there, right? And I'm cutting lemons, and he comes towards me. And I take a knife to him, you know what I mean? So I'm definitely like, something's like, I am not spiritually fit. I'm like, I'm going to kill people now, you know what I mean? So I call my grandfather up and I'm like, I don't think I'm doing so well. I don't think I'm doing good at all. I'm like threatening people. I'm like threatening to poke them with knives and stuff. And 2 days later, my grandfather got on a plane and flew out to Florida. And I tell you, people that have been put in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous are just absolutely amazing. The way they lay down their life and they show up is just blows my mind. And I tell you, I hope to be like them one day. You know, I hope to be able to just drop anything and roll when I'm called. And they do try to. The people that I've had in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous are the best people I've ever met in my entire life, and they're the craziest, you know. My grandfather, he's kind of like my dad, you know. He's funny and nasty and sarcastic. He's awesome. But I tell you, my daughter, she's 24 years old. She called me last year, and she said, and this is when I was still in New York, and she said she was pregnant, and she was she called me and she said she was in labor. And she said, Mom, will you please come? I'm in labor. I want you to be here. And I got in my car and I drove to Jersey and I got there in time to sit through the whole labor with her. And I got to watch my little granddaughter be born. And I tell you, I thought my heart was going to explode when I seen that little baby. And I tell you, I would have missed all of this if it wasn't for the rooms like this, you people, the 12 steps in God.
and for that I will forever grateful. And I really hope that God may have touched the government tonight. Thanks.